So if I may introduce our first guest, this is Kenny Rohr, someone I haven't seen since the 1970s. I have really been looking forward to this, Kenny. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Thank you very much. I know we have three speakers coming up here, so I'm going to talk fast, which means you're going to have to listen faster as we go through this. And there will be a test on this at the end of the presentation, so I hope you brought your pencils and paper with you to prepare for the test. It would take a brave man, as well as a lot of hay, to ride a mule around the world, a real risk taker. And certainly Charlie Poole would fit that category. He was a risk taker. Consider, for example, in the summer of 1925, this man, who could not read a stop sign, went to New York on his own without invitation, with his thick Southern dialect, and asked for an audition with a record company. Now, this guy was a North Carolina cotton mill worker, what they call lint heads, and I don't use that term in a derogatory sense at all. My mother went to work in a cotton mill just after her 16th birthday. If she'd have worked three more months, she'd have been there 52 years. I worked in the weave room myself on the third shift. I used to come out in the morning with the lint stuck to my head. And what I remember about my mother working in the mill is her hair would be dyed whatever color yarn they were running that day. Her hair would be yellow or purple or blue or green or whatever, and she always smelled like lint. And I know that I did, too, after working in the weave room. I used to tell my students that I thought any student who graduated from high school should immediately be put in a weave room, that then they'd appreciate the value of an education in a way they could not in any other way. At any rate, Charlie Poole, this lint head from North Carolina, his thick Southern North Carolina dialect, goes to New York on his own and asks for an audition. And again, this is a man who could not read a stop sign. I have a copy of his 1917 draft registration card, and at the bottom it has a place for his signature. Instead, it has an X. If he didn't want people to know who he was, he'd probably put a circle around that X. But at any rate, he had an X. I'm just kidding for the humor impaired. At any rate, he had an X there with the notation written, his mark. So here's a man who was illiterate, thick Southern accent, goes to New York, finds his way to Columbia Records, and asks for an audition. Thank goodness Frank Walker, who was the A&R man for Columbia Records then, gave him a listen and said, we'll record you. On July the 27th, 1925, Charlie Poole, accompanied by his brother-in-law, Posey Rohr, on fiddle. That's Posey with a fiddle, Charlie sitting there with a banjo, and a guy named Norman Woodleaf. That's not Norman Woodleaf there. I'll explain him later. But at any rate, the three of them auditioned for Columbia Records, and Frank Walker had them cut four records. The first song he recorded was a song called The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. What Charlie said, and this is where his accent comes into play, what Charlie really sang on the record, and it was correct, was The Girl I Loved in Sunny Tennessee. But in the very first verse, he sings The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. Around where I live, I still hear people say, I love to do this, I love to do that. I hear people say, once upon a time, you know, sticking a T on once, that kind of thing. At any rate, he sang The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. Well, it came out as a mistake on the record label as The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. And it's interesting that to this day, bluegrass groups that record that song still record it as The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. Mark Newton has that out on his latest Rebel CD. I was hoping Dave Freeman would be here, so I'd give him a plug. But it's on his latest CD, as The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. And you can trace that mistake right back to Charlie Poole's record, in fact. So he recorded The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee. He recorded I'm the Man That Rode the Mule Around the World, Don't Let Your Deal Go Down Blues, and Can I Sleep in Your Barn Tonight, Mister? The band, instead of receiving royalties, opted for a $75 payment. Now, Charlie Poole let his deal go down that time because that first record released, Don't Let Your Deal Go Down Blues and Can I Sleep in Your Barn Tonight, Mister, sold an astounding 102,451 copies. The second release, I'm the Man That Rode the Mule Around the World and The Girl I Left in Sunny Tennessee, sold 65,500 copies. Now, even though he didn't get any royalties from that, and too bad that he didn't, it did free him from his spinning room job in the spray cotton mills. And now he was able to make his living full-time as a musician. Over the next 5 years, he and his band would go to New York, and they would cut a 76 additional sides for Columbia, Paramount, and Brunswick Records. What I'm going to do with you today is consider the sources of Charlie Poole's material. Where did he get these songs? Remember, he was a literate guy, so he wasn't reading the sheet music, believe me. So where did he get all this material? Poole's sources are very varied. They include folk ballads, Tin Pan Alley tunes, blues, popular songs, etc. of the day. Now, when Charlie recorded I'm the Man That Rode the Mule Around the World, that's a good example of how he took a Tin Pan Alley song and adapted it to suit his own taste. Charlie Poole and his band were playing one day at a bootlegging joint on the North Carolina-Virginia line. I assume everybody knows what a bootlegging joint is. Do I have any Baptists in here? They know what that is. At any rate, I'm just kidding, again, for the humor impaired. But at any rate, they were playing at a bootlegging joint on the North Carolina-Virginia line, and Norman Woodleaf's brother, Will Woodleaf, rode up on a mule. Will was drunk. He was firing a pistol in the air. And the last thing a mule wants is to someone fire a pistol in its ear. You know, they're cantankerous creatures to start with. And the result was the mule took him on a wild bucking ride and finally threw him off against a pine tree. Well, Charlie Poole began to tease Will Woodleaf and called him, making up this term himself, the man that rode the mule around the world. What Charlie will do, as you're going to see near the end of my presentation, he takes an 1874 song written by a guy named Harry Clyde and another gentleman, H.C. Vernon, called I'm a Highly Educated Man. And Charlie took that song, added I'm the Man Who Rode the Mule Around the World, and then added his own verse at the end of the song, which makes the song kind of an inside joke, as you're going to see. As I was mentioning, Charlie Poole's sources were many and varied. He was very open-minded, very eclectic, and he would adapt any song, no matter the source, if it suited his taste. He could make Tin Pan Alley songs sound like old-time mountain ballads. He could take old-time mountain ballads and make them sound like something that was newly written, very new and very snappy. He changed minor keys to major keys, and he straightened out the tunes, dropped all the embellishments and flourishes, so that it would fit fiddle band music. He put his own interpretation, as I said, on songs like the H.C. Vernon song, I'm the Man Rode the Mule Around the World, combining a Tin Pan Alley song with his own experience. An analysis of 66 songs and tunes from Poole's recorded repertoire shows that well over half of his pieces came from Tin Pan Alley. 37 of his 66 titles were Tin Pan Alley produced and can be directly traced to Tin Pan Alley. An additional 8 recordings have no known composer, but they certainly have a Tin Pan Alley feel to them. The Wayward Boy, Buddy Rose, and Sweet 16 sounds like they were probably produced on Tin Pan Alley. 21 songs and tunes mostly likely came from the folk tradition. These would include things like My Gypsy Girl, which in the British Isles is called The Gypsy Wedding Day, and Hangman, Hangman, Slack the Rope, which is another old British ballad called The Gallows Pole. I think it's Child Ballad number 95. That'll be on the test. At any rate, that's another one of those English ballads. And at least 9 of the fiddle tunes came from European sources. His recording of Under the Double Eagle, of course, is a 1902 Austrian military march. Remember, the double eagle was the symbol of Austria. And then there are tunes like Wild Horse, which is really Pigtown Fling over in the British Isles. And Mountain Reel, as Posey called it, is really Miss McLeod's reel. I don't think Charlie was the source of the fiddle tunes. Posey Rohr most likely was the source of those. So the question then comes up, how did a man who could not read and write his own name learn these songs? Well, there are several possibilities. Roy Harvey, the guy there, a railroad engineer from West Virginia, became Poole's guitarist in 1926. Norman Woodleaf had tuberculosis and floated in and out of sanatoriums, and he could not keep up with Charlie Poole's all night playing and rambling and so on and so forth. So Roy Harvey, this railroad engineer, became Poole's guitarist, and he was likely the source for 8 to 10 of these 10 Pan Alley influenced recordings that Poole did. Harvey recorded 8 songs prior to Poole recording them. These include Sweet Sunny South, for example, which Harvey recorded twice in 1927, 2 years before Poole did it. He recorded it with Posey Rohrer for Columbia in May of 27, which went unissued, I might add. And then he recorded it for Paramount Records in the fall of 1927. Harvey also recorded What Is Home Without Love, or What Is Home Without Babies, as Charlie called it, Goodbye Mary Dear, Write a Letter to My Mother, Bill Mason, I Cannot Call Her Mother, Take Back the Engagement Ring, and a number of other tunes that Poole would later record. Harvey recorded, as I said, many of these at least 2 years before Poole did. Harvey also recorded Milwaukee Blues and Where the Whippoorwill is Whispering Goodnight, but he recorded those after Poole, but very soon after Poole did. And it may be that Poole had already learned them from Harvey earlier and then recorded them in this case. Now, how did Harvey come to know these songs? Well, his sister, Lucy Terry, was a trained pianist. She was a well-educated lady who recorded with Poole on a number of occasions. She later became comptroller at Old Dominion University down in southeast Virginia. So she was a very well-educated lady who played the piano, and she may have had all of the sheet music, or at least some of it. Another point is that Roy Harvey worked in the Beckley Music Store. He lost his job in a railroad strike in 1923, and he worked as a streetcar conductor for a while, and then he went to work full-time in the Beckley Music Store, and they had sheet music. So he may have had access to the sheet music there, or when he belonged to a young men's quartet, in the pre-World War I era. He sang in a quartet, and he certainly was aware of the popular tunes of the day. Now, let me show you some of the sheet music that I'm talking about. Here is Come Take a Trip in My Airship, written in 1904. Charlie will record this as I once loved a sailor, in fact. Here is a copy of What Is Home Without Love by Charles K. Harris, who also wrote There'll Come a Time and Mid the Green Fields of Virginia and a number of other songs, some that the Carter family recorded, in fact. And Harvey recorded this as What Is Home Without Love. Poole recorded it that same year as What Is Home Without Babies, which is quiet, of course. See who's listening? You were listening. Okay. Falling by the Wayside, or as Charlie Poole called it, Falling by the Wayside. And then, of course, Baby Rose, which Poole recorded as Just Keep Waiting Till the Good Times Come, one of the last records he did, in fact. So, at any rate, here's the sheet music. Harvey certainly would have had access to it. Certainly his sister, Lucy, did. And in addition, Ernest V. Stoneman, Kelly Harrell, and Walter Kidd Smith were all musical pals of Charlie Poole. They performed together from time to time. And they recorded some songs that Poole later recorded. And Poole may have picked them up from Ernest Stoneman or Kidd Smith or Kelly Harrell. Poole may have adapted their material, in other words. It is highly likely that Poole was influenced by recordings he heard, though he did not own a phonograph. He didn't have one at home until after 1925. He didn't have a phonograph before that. But he could have gone in a hardware store, a general store, and for a nickel, he could have dropped it in a Columbia BS graphophone, and he could have heard Billy Murray's 1905 recording of Come Take a Trip in My Airship, or he could have heard the 1906 recording by Cal Stewart of Monkey on a String, though there are some very significant differences between those particular recordings. In 1899, S.H. Dudley had recorded The Girl I Loved in Sunny Tennessee for Berliner Records, and Arthur Collins had recorded It's Moving Day in 1906. Poole could have heard these on a neighbor's phonograph. Certainly traveling musical shows could have been another source of songs for Poole. Since Poole would have been illiterate during this period, everything would have been learned orally, which may help explain some of his garbled lyrics. and how he messes up on some of the songs. He sings the third verse first and the second verse last, and he does do some of that on The Wayward Boy, for example. On Falling by the Wayside, he takes two lines of one verse and the last two lines of a very different verse and combines them into a single verse. And again, I suspect he was probably doing all that from memory, and it may have been songs that he heard 25 or 30 years later. And he may have not been sober either when he learned some of these songs. And that may, when I was talking to my wife about this, she said, "Well, are you going to tell them that Charlie did this?" I said, "Well, yeah, they probably know that, I suspect." But at any rate, anything he recorded prior to the late 1920s, he would have had to learn by ear, which may explain some of his errors, some of his mistakes. Now, his wife, Luema, taught him how to read and write, at least elementary reading and writing, in or about 1927, so he could sign a Columbia contract. She would hold his hand and teach him how to write Charlie C. Poole so he could sign a contract with Columbia Records. And what he began to do then, at least by 1929, is use typed sheets that had the words typed out on them. And I'll show you two examples. So if later you want to come up and hold something that Charlie Poole held in his hands, you can come hold this. There's just a small fee involved. here's the words to "Goodbye, Mary Dear" that Charlie recorded in 1929. And right underneath it is his spidery handwriting, Charlie C. Poole. It's the same signature I have on his 1927 Columbia contract. So there's Charlie Poole's handwriting underneath "Goodbye, Mary Dear." And here is one he recorded in 1930. I have a whole stack of these that came out of his trunk. This one is "Write a Letter to My Mother" that he did in 1930. And notice that it's typed on the Beckley Music Store stationery, too. Now, I don't think Charlie typed it. Roy Harvey could have typed it. I suspect probably Lucy Terry typed these words out for Charlie, so he would have them maybe there in the studio, or at least when they were practicing. So once he learned to read and write, he began to use sheets like this in his recording session. Now, some of his songs cannot be traced back any further than Charlie Poole, at least on record I'm speaking of. "Budded Rose" appears only in Charlie Poole's recording initially. No one else had recorded before him, apparently. Also, "The Baltimore Fire," no one had recorded that before him. And he may have gotten "Baltimore Fire" from songbooks, and let me show you these. Since he had learned to read and write now, and this is a Maori songster, a Xerox copy that a good friend of mine ran off for me, and I appreciate it. He's here today. And this has the words to "Baltimore Fire" in it. Now, no one had recorded that song prior to Poole. Now, where he got it, I don't know. He could have gotten it out of a book like this, though there are verses in this rendition of it that are not in Poole's version. So if he took it from this booklet, he didn't use all of it. And then I have three books at home that belong to a guy named Bernice Coleman, who recorded with Roy Harvey in 1931 for Champion Records and then for OK Records. And Coleman was a fine fiddler and singer. And Coleman had these little books that he gave me, and it's just words to songs. And as I flip through these little booklets, I find songs that were recorded by the Carter family, by Fiddlin' John Carson, by Charlie Poole, and others. So these little books, A.P. Carter may have been using books like this, Ernest Stoneman may have used books like this, but these little books I know were a source for B.B. Coleman, because he recorded some of these same songs, and he has written beside the words B.B., meaning that would be recorded by B.B. Coleman, by Bernice Coleman. Now I want to play a few examples of what Charlie Poole did with these 10 Pan Alley songs. And you can see how he dropped the minor keys, went to major keys, straightened out the tunes, and kind of put his own spin on this, his own arrangement of these songs. Not unlike what A.P. Carter did in rearranging songs like "Wildwood Flower," like Mack Wiseman did in bluegrass with things like "Put My Little Shoes Away," how he had his own arrangements as well. So we'll listen to a few of these, and I'm just going to play little snippets. We'll start off with Come Take a Trip in My Airship by Billy Murray from 1905, and we'll follow that immediately after maybe a verse of it. We'll follow that immediately with Charlie Poole doing I Once Loved a Sailor, and it's a good example of what Charlie did with a Tin Pan Alley tune. Come Take a Trip in My Airship. This is a PowerPoint presentation. I have the power, and I'm pointing. Okay. All right. That's you.
Come Take a Trip in My Airship, sung by Billy Murray at a Sun Record. I love a sailor loves me, and sails every night to my home. He's not a sailor that sails o'er the sea, but over the wild briny foam. For he owns an airship and sails upon high, he's just like a bird on the wing. And when the shadows of evening draw nigh, he'll sail to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship, come take a sail among the stars, come have a ride around Venus, come have a spin around Mars.
All right, Charlie Poole. 23 years later. Come have a sail round the Mars. We'll visit Vision as he stands instead of Venus there. We'll play a little bit of Oh, Didn't He Ramble by Arthur Collins from 1902 on an Edison record he did. We'll jump up 27 years and listen to Charlie Poole's rendition of it from May 1929. And you'll notice some differences in the first verse that Collins sings, then the first verse that Poole sings, and there are some differences in the way those two verses are done. And in the final verse, the third verse, and I'm not going to play the third verse of either version of this, but I think Charlie put his own spin on the third verse. In the third verse on the Arthur Collins version, he sings about the renter who wouldn't pay his landlord, that the landlord kicked him over the fence, loop-de-loop. Charlie Poole says the landlord kicked him over the fence right in a barrel of slop. And I think a lot of rural Southerners would understand that term a lot quicker than they would loop-de-loop in a barrel of slop. Everybody knew what that was. So we'll play those two back-to-back. Oh, Didn't He Ramble.
Oh, Didn't He Ramble, sung by Arthur Collins at a Sun Record. Full-grown sons, Buster, Bill, and Beep. And Buster was the black sheep of the Beebe family. They tried their best to break him off his rough and rowdy ways. At last they had to get a judge to give him 90 days. Oh, didn't he ramble, ramble.
Now it's hillbilly music. No mention of the Beebe family in Poole's version.
My mother raised three grown sons, Buster, Bill, and I. Buster was a black sheep, our little family. Mother tried to break him of his rough and rowdy ways. Finally had to get the judge to give him 90 days. And didn't he ramble, ramble, ramble. rambled all around, in and out the town, and didn't he ramble, ramble. He rambled till the butchers put him down.
All right, we'll listen to a little bit of Arthur Collins once again. And I have some of the 78s, the original 78s by Arthur Collins and others that I brought that you can take a look at if you have time. And we're going to listen to Arthur Collins do Moving Day in 1906, and then we're going to jump up 24 years to Charlie Poole's version from January 1930. And again, this is a good example of Charlie straightening out a tune and getting rid of the embellishments and flourishes.
Landlord says this the morning to me, give me your key, this flat ain't free. I can't get no rent out of you, pack up your things and get to you. I've been waiting till my bills come home. Here's my honey from the honeycomb. He'll have money cause he told me so this morning. Landlord said I give you lots to show. I want my rooms or else I want my dough. I'll wait for Bill if he don't pay, why I'll to go. Because
come home, keep my honey from the honeycomb. He'll have money, cause he told me so this morning.
And it's almost moving day for me here. I need to wind this up. And I had a couple more songs I was going to play. I was going to play You Ain't Talking to Me, both the Tin Pan Alley version and the Poole version. And I brought my Victor phonograph over there. I was going to play Frank Crummett doing Frankie and Johnny and then Poole's version of it and show you the differences there. But I'm kind of running out of time, so I'm going to do one more song here. And this is the one that I think best illustrates Poole's adaptation of a Tin Pan Alley tune and putting his own twist to it, his own arrangement to it. We'll go to disc two, number seven. This is I'm the Man That Rode the Mule Round the World. I'll go back where I started here. Remember the incident that precipitated the song. They're playing at a bootlegger joint on the North Carolina-Virginia line. Remember, bootleggers built there so they could escape into the other state if the police came. There was a bootlegger in Danville who was on the North Carolina-Virginia line, and he built he had a portable state sign that he would move from one side of the building to the other. I kid you not. Richard Bigger, who was an old-time musician, recorded for OK Records in 1927 from Danville, told me that story. I think he knew wherever he spoke. But anyway, they were playing at the bootlegging joint. Will Woodleaf rode up, firing a pistol on the air. Will Woodleaf was drunk. The mule took him on a wild bucking ride, threw him off in the pine tree, and Charlie Poole started calling him the man that rode the mule around the world. Listen to the very last verse of this song, and you'll hear Charlie Poole with his own addition to the song where he sings, I rode up to the line and I fell off against a pine. I'm the man that rode the mule around the world. Again, referencing that incident. And I suspect when this record came out, there were record buyers there in Spray, North Carolina, where he lived, who probably heard that verse and, aha, they knew what he was talking about. It was like an inside joke that the folks around there who had been up to that bootlegging joint, certainly all the Baptist buyers of this record would have known what it was, to got the inside joke here. I'm just picking on the Baptist. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm the man that rode the mule around the world.
From us to meet me when the clock struck 23. Down at the start gun, about a mile and a half away. My pickle peeping hawk ears, one night he sent the pound. See my freckled face, something very gay. Oh, she's a dainty, she's black eyed and crazy. A fierce girl I thought I ever saw. Now her dress smells sweet, but I just never speak. For she's my freckled face, something very gay.
Norman Woodleaf told me they were all terrified the day they made these records. He said, Charlie said, it's a wonder you didn't hear the sound of the butterflies on the record when he was singing. And he told Norman he'd never record sober again.
I'm the man who rode the mule around the world. I'm the man who rode the mule around the world. I rode it all his lot, and I'm happy as a lot. I'm the man who rode the mule around the world.
Last verse will incorporate I'm a highly educated man, that 1894 composition. And then tacked on to that verse will be the verse about I wrote it to the line, I fell off against the pine.
I'm a highly educated man, and this ain't my brain that I have planned. Now I've been on earth too long till I've learned to sing a song that old Abraham and Jacob used to say. I'm the man who rode the mule around the world.
It's coming up.
I rode the mule around the world. I rode it all his arm. He surrounded me with a job. I'm the man rode the mule around the world. I'm the man rode the mule around the world. I'm the man rode the mule around the world. I rode up to the line and I fell against the pine. I'm the man rode the mule around the world.
Very true. There you go. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Can we ask you some questions?
Yes. Do I have to answer them?
How are you related to the famous
Posey Rohr was my dad's uncle, also my dad's legal guardian, and Charlie Poole married Posey Rohr's sister. So they were brothers-in-law, and my dad lived in the house with Charlie Poole for about 10 years. It wasn't always pleasant, but it was never boring.
Question. A lot of times in the 30s, at least, A&R directors would gear the performer's repertoire towards traditional tunes as opposed to well-known tunes.
Right.
I know Robert Johnson played a lot of Tin Pan Alley songs in performance.
Mm-hmm. I think he let him record whatever he wanted to up to a point. When Charlie went up there in 1929, with a five-piece band, twin fiddles, and a piano player, and a banjo and guitar, Walker would not let him record with that combination. So Walker did say no from time to time, but Charlie was his own man. I mean, he really was a very independent person, and he kind of did it his way. And I figure, and I wonder if Walker certainly realized Poole was illiterate early on, and probably didn't expect him to learn anything that was, formally produced, perhaps. A supposition on my part. Yes, sir?
I was wondering also about how long did this Edison record stay in print at that time? Did they really stay available for 27 years?
I doubt that. Edison ceased all cylinder production in, I believe, June of 29 or March of 29, somewhere in that bracket. But, see, Poole would have been a kid when these tunes were coming out, 1902, 1905, 1909. You know, he was born 1892, so he'd have been 10 years old, for example, when that first cylinder recording came out. And that's why I speculate he may have heard it on a Columbia BS graphophone. You know, it's like a jukebox. You drop a nickel in it, and it plays you a cylinder for a nickel. So I suspect that's how he heard some of this, too. Some of it I think he got from Harvey. Some of it he may have gotten from Ernie Stoneman and Kelly Harrell. And, you know, it's hard to say with any certainty where he got all this material. So I'm speculating that Harvey was a major source. I think Harvey had a big influence on Poole as time went by.
We're going to need to cut off ahead mm-hmm. so we give our other presenters sure. care about time. I'd just add one thing on my own. Kenny, I believe these are the first electrically recorded string band records, aren't they?
Yes, Columbia had just gone electric in June of 25. Yeah. When Poole showed up in July, so these would have been
a good time.
Yeah, he got there just in time, just in time. He didn't know where he was, but he got there just in time. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. That is never Charlie Poole. Just the stories are endless, and they are never less than enlightening. And there's a wonderful, wonderful series of props too. Nice that we'll have a chance to go and look at them up close.